Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. And our panel are here poised, but let's have a look at the front pages of the Sunday papers. So the Sunday Independent is leading with, you heard it there on the news again. We spoke to Mark Tighe and Marie Crowe about this yesterday. Multiple women allege sexual advances by male FAI coaches. Harrowing claims of forced trainees. International players reveal ordeals. Ex-FAI boss tells of homophobic rant quotes. And there are the straps underneath that. And then you come on to the Mail. New sex scandal allegations hit Defence Forces. A member of the Defence Forces has been accused of sexually harassing several female colleagues under his command, the Irish Mail on Sunday can reveal. And then you come on to the Sunday Mirror. Why was he still allowed to taxi? So apparently, according to this story by Sylvia Ponal, Gardaí were powerless to stop repeat sex offender Raymond Shorten driving a taxi to prey on women because of a legal glitch. So he had been guilty of previous sex crimes, but they were not sufficient to revoke his SPSV licence under the Taxi Regulation Act, according to this. The Business Post is leading with the budget. 5 billion budget boost on cards as coalition to defy central bank. It will include a tax package broadly in line with last year's 1.15 billion package, according to this. Core spending is expected to increase by at least 4 billion. And then we have, of course, this non-core expenditure wheeze, and that's 4.5 billion of that as well. The Sunday Times is leading with Aer Lingus gives iPhones to cabin crew. So last week, Aer Lingus emailed 2,000 full-time and part-time cabin crew members asking them to book a slot to collect a new iPhone 15. So the Aer Lingus say it's to improve digitalisation as part of their connected crew investment programme. But I think some people are suggesting that, you know, is this kind of a sweetener against the background of the industrial relations difficulties Aer Lingus are having at the moment. Their off lead is a royal visit for new era of UK-Irish relations. So King Charles III could make a historic state visit to Ireland next year. Of course, King Charles III has been in Ireland many, many times. I think his ambition was to get to all the counties in Ireland, and I think he's been to many of them, so he is, it seems, a lover of this country. The Sunday World is leading with Harris versus the Monk. Garda Chief Drew takes High Court case against Gerry Hutch, his Regency co-accused, and DPP. Now, it's not some kind of personal case. They say it's likely to be a technical issue related to the David Byrne murder trial. And The Sun on Sunday has the story of, you will remember Stephen Termini, who was the tourist who was attacked in Talbot Street, I think it was, in Dublin last summer. He is now suing his son in a row over €120,000 that was raised on a GoFundMe. Okay. Our panel this morning, Louise Byrne is political correspondent with the Irish Mirror. Gerard Howland is a public affairs consultant and an Irish Times columnist. Tanya Ward is chief executive of the Children's Rights Alliance. And Dr. Kevin Cunningham is a lecturer in politics at TU Dublin and founder of Ireland Thinks, the polling company. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning, man.
Louise, we'll start with the front page of the Sunday Independent, and of course that will be broadcast tonight as well. It's a co-investigation between RT and the Sunday Independent. It'll be broadcast tonight at 9:30 as an RT investigates programme. So we won't have any loose talk around this, but can you tell us the guts of this story?
Yeah, this is quite the investigation in the Sunday Independent today, like you said, in conjunction with RTE Investigates. It's the front page and then it's five pages inside by Mark Tighe and Marie Crowe. So quite a lot of investigations gone into this, and what their report is saying is that multiple female footballers have claimed they were subjected to sexual advances from FAI coaches in the 1990s. And this, by and large, focuses on former female international players who were on a FOSS course, which was the kind of the first state-funded course for female football players. And The allegations are quite harrowing, is what the Sunday Independent describes them as. So of a lot of women that they've spoken to, 5 of 20 course trainees have claimed they were subject to sexual advances during the false course from their head coach, who the Sunday Independent names as Eamon Collins. And that is, you know, that ranges from 18-year-olds going on dates with Collins, who was 31 years old at the time. And it was suggested that this would open doors for her career, and more, you know, sexual advances, be that, you know, kisses, be that dates, in kind of incidences in changing rooms. There's also allegations against from international players from the 1990s about Mick Cook, who was the manager at the time. A lot of that focuses on homophobia. They suggested that there was homophobic rants that took place. And there was also, you know, players who were out at the time, which is quite remarkable for the 1990s. You know, it was a very different era. So they were suggesting that there was, you know, homophobia against them. And then again, more sexual advances. Now, both men in the Sunday Independent have denied this, but I was listening to Mark Tighe speak about this. And, you know, it's quite clear that a lot of work has gone into this, a lot of investigation has gone into this, that, you know, I think it's something like 2 years of an investigation that this has been worked on. So, like I said, quite substantial. The front page of the Sunday Independent today, 5 pages on the inside, featuring testimonials from women who have spoken out about this, who have gone on the record, which, you know, is a very brave thing to do, and it takes a lot of guts. But yeah, I think it'd be very interesting.
A lot of the women were reluctant, as you would be, to do this. But I think Mark and Marie were saying it was when they all met up and started talking to each other, and it stiffened their spines, and they suddenly said no. Actually, women who didn't want to go on camera and stuff were suddenly saying no. Actually, we are doing this.
And a lot of them also didn't realise that this was not just mm-hmm. them, that it was, you know, it was pretty more widespread perhaps than they had believed, and they thought this was something personal against them. And, you know, it's not easy to come out and speak about any of these things. It's certainly not easy to do it 30 years after the event. You would assume that a lot of these women had kept this quiet, had not spoken to their family or their friends about these allegations, certainly don't seem, to have spoken to each other. So it's very brave. And, you know, I think not only speaking to a newspaper, but agreeing to go on the television, and that documentary, like you said, is on RTE this evening. So like the Sunday Independent has described it, it's quite harrowing. So even reading the reports in the paper this morning was harrowing. So imagine what it's going to be like hearing those women speaking on television.
Yeah,
I've seen
bits of it, and it's not good. It's not good at all. Tanya, I suppose there's a few important background things to this. One is that, as Marie Crowe was saying, these were young women mm-hmm. with dreams. These men were the gatekeepers, so that consensual relations take on a very different take on a very different meaning in those circumstances, don't we?
Yeah. Between the two, I mean, that's one of the headlines that really struck out for me. Soccer was the only thing that I was good at, and after that, it just destroyed me. I mean, you know, on a personal level, you know, every time these stories come out, I just go, not again. Was no one safe in the country? That's the kind of feeling. I think most people feel that when they see these stories being reported. I mean, and I look at these kinds of, in terms of the sporting area, a lot of work goes into Children First and having safeguarding statements and training and vetting people. And sometimes I think for the clubs, they seem it's a bit of a burden for them. But the truth of it, if you don't have these measures in place, you have cases like this that emerge. I think in relation to this particular case, I have to credit the media organisations, because I think it can't be lost. This took 2 years of investigation by the Sunday Times and RTE.
Independent.
And it takes money and resources to do this type of investigation, because, of course, it's fraught with legal challenge. And we need to keep that focus in the media. I mean, I think when we look at the solution to this, I think we need to understand why did this actually happen, and make sure that the women who've come front and centre, and really they've come forward, I think, to expose what happened, so other girls and young women who enter sports don't have their dreams crushed and don't have to live with, you know, the harm caused by these kind of events that can happen.
Do you think now, what you were saying at the beginning there, we look back, like, and look, it was schools, scouts, cub scouts,
yeah.
sports, swimming. Do you think that at a particular point in Ireland, like, was every organisation or were a vast number of organisations, this was going on right across the board?
Yes, this is the truth of it. I mean, the reality of, if you look at Ireland at the past, see, children were seen and not heard. And when these events happened, these institutions would respond to them in a very similar way. And they looked at it, what harm is it going to cause to our institution?
Terms of the FAI, it's a blurred area about who knew what. Complaints were made, I think, in one case, and then everyone involved seems to have said it didn't happen.
But if you were to take the Ryan report, which looked at the industrial schools, and this is the hallmark of a lot of the different institutions and bodies that dealt with this, they looked at sexual abuse as a moral failing on the person. They didn't look at it as a crime, and they looked at protecting their own institution. And that's why you see this again and again. And I suppose it's why we had a referendum on children, to make sure people that, no, children have rights, they should be protected. They are entitled to go into sports and not expected to have advances or any kind of events happen against them.
From what you know now, from your work with the Children's Rights Alliance, would you feel children and young people, teenage girls, etc., are safe in general in this country?
I think there's been massive work done with the sporting organisations and the youth organisations. Like, they are kind of the girl guides, etc. They're leading the way in terms of really good child protection and welfare practices. But it is the case that there are, you know, significant levels of abuse happening in society. I mean, even only in the last week, Women's Aid, Dublin Rape Crisis Centre reported, you know, record levels of people coming forward reporting abuse. And one of the elements of that is what's happening in everyday life. You know, we kind of accept, you know, violence. We kind of accept there's issues with consent. Like, the studies are showing that sometimes teenagers, and a significant number of them, don't seem to understand consent and the rules around it. And girls mostly feel that they have to comply and are coerced into these situations. I mean, the government, I mean, even you read out all the headlines there, Brendan, and it keeps on reminding us we have a big problem when it comes to violence against women in this society. The government have a zero tolerance strategy in place. That's critical that the next government keeps the same focus on that and resources the new agency, Cuan, in relation to space. Because I think we need to start at the very beginning. We need to make sure the curriculum is pretty clear, the schools are pretty clear, we're teaching kind of what healthy relationships actually are in everyday life. And children and young people need to know no one has the right to commit these kind of crimes against you, and you should be able to protect yourself and step forward, and the adults in charge are going to step forward and protect you.
Louise, broadly right now, do we have a cultural problem around violence against women and attitudes to women, young men? I know I'm moving away a bit from this now, but it obviously there's a broader conversation been going on for the last few weeks.
I mean, I think the array of headlines that you read out there at the top of the programme showed that there is. And I mean, this is not something new. And I've been here discussing this with you before, that it's a societal thing. And, you know, Tanya mentions the government strategy. And listen, there's things that the government should be doing that they're not. There should be more refuge spaces. There needs to be better education. Yes, I agree. But I remember being at the launch of that strategy and Helen McEntee said something like, I can't be in your WhatsApp group. I can't be on all your nights out. I can't be in every single pub. This has to be a societal thing. And I think she was right. And I think, unfortunately, some of the reports in the paper show today that men believe that, and I can't believe that it's still this, that this is the case, but there's a sense of entitlement there amongst men that they believe, you know, that they can do this to women, that they can do that to women. And it's just, in this day and age, it's amazing that there's still this societal issue there. And you hear it in the way that some men speak about women, you see it in other men's actions, and it's not all men.
Younger men as well, like, we would have thought that there's a generation coming up now who are more enlightened and, to use the word, woke and all that.
But I think there's a very concerning social media side of this as well. You have seen so-called influencers, and their attitude towards women is absolutely appalling, and that is rubbing off on a younger generation. And it's quite frightening to hear some of the things that these men online are saying about women, and you're going, for Christ's sake, it's 2024, how can anyone still have this attitude? But it is a societal thing, and it's, you know, it's this idea of, it's not all men, but you don't know what man that it could be, you don't know what man that it is, and there's always going to be bad apples out there. And, you know, I think it starts with within groups of men, and I think this has to be called out, and I think this has to be done, yeah. of groups of men going to their pal who's made a derogatory comment about a woman, just going, that's not okay. You can't say that. You can't do that. And I think until we have that level of confidence and that level of, you know, belief amongst men that they need to be calling these things out, this is going to continue to be a problem, and women need to call it out as well.
And alongside that is the proliferation yeah. of pornography, you know, that's yeah. promoting kind of harmful, extreme, violent sex alongside that as well. That has to be dealt with.
Yeah. OK. And look, just to go back, that this is a broader conversation, obviously. Yeah. The FAI allegations are about sexual advances and an imbalance of power. And this is we are talking about the broader issues that have been aired in this country in the last few weeks. Gerard, going back to the FAI and the nuts and bolts of this, there were no guidelines or anything in place at that time around relationships between coaches and players.
I was a special advisor in the Department of Sport for some of that time, from 97 to about 2 years, in the middle of 97 to the middle of 99. And the big issue then was sexual abuse in the sport of swimming. It was a major, major issue. More widely, where was
and, and there's no suggestion that no, sexual abuse is not the, is not the exact story here.
In that case, the perpetrator had already been convicted and jailed. And it was, if you like, what had happened within the sport of swimming, how had that been allowed, how had complaints gone unheard. And of course, the sport of swimming, the organisation was stood down, it was defunded, and it was started back up from scratch as a result of all of that. And a man who later became a judge, Roderick Murphy, did a very fine report into all of that at the time. But more generally, no. But what I do remember about the sports scene at that time was the swagger of the men. And they were all men. I don't remember very many of any women. I'm sure there must have been somewhere, but it was a very male-dominated situation. There wasn't much at stake, frankly. Most of those sports organisations, the GA, the IRFU, and indeed the IFA, were very distinct in that they were significantly bigger. Most sports organisations were small to tiny. But there was a continuous thread of attitude and among the leadership of people who were on committees, and this was their life, the so-called Blazers. And I mean, I remember them coming into meetings with the minister, with the department about funding, and the arrogance and the swagger was something
okay.
to...
And look, I'm just being super careful yeah. here, but obviously you mentioned other sports organisations there. There's no suggestion that there was anything like this going on in the other big organisations. Kevin, what do you think of all that?
Well, yeah, no, I mean, referencing what Louise was talking about, there was a very interesting article as well by Lynn Kelleher about the role of education in particular. It was following up from a study by Dr. Daniel Kane, which did a survey and tried to understand the environments more generally, again, separate from the incidents that we're talking about, but more generally about attackers and that sort of stuff. And the context of this is trying to say how it's men you know, I guess, which it relates to. But it also highlights the relative importance of consent and speaking up amongst friends, I guess, whether people see things. And it just in terms of the context, Louise also mentioned the influencers, which is also quite interesting, because you kind of see, at least, I mean, I'm looking at everything from a kind of a political lens in some respect, and how you see this divergence, at least amongst younger people, younger men and younger women, where younger men are drifting a little bit more towards the right. And a lot of that kind of sentiment is also reflected not just within sort of attitudes towards immigration, but also attitudes in relation to these sorts of issues as well. So the educational component is obviously very important, but it also needs to be a very kind of well thought out educational piece, if that makes sense. So yeah, it needs yeah. to kind of consider what are the channels of communication and how does one address maybe some underlying concerns that exist there within younger men as well, and trying to understand that sort of stuff. I know that's very different to what we're talking about, obviously, but
but look at that, like, as I keep saying, there has been a broader conversation going on. There's a principal of a secondary school has texted in here, and he says, we're doing our very best in education to educate our young people, but to what you're saying, Kevin, until there are proper controls on social media access and gaming, promoting violence against women, things are just going to get much worse. Parents are not taking proper responsibility or putting in control. So look, there's definitely a huge broader societal issue there. Okay, we leave that there. Louise, there's a lot of politics going on for summertime, but one of the more kind of gossipy things in the Mail on Sunday today is Micheál's big plan, move to the Oras, John Lee is saying.
Yeah, this I guess has been like a topic of conversation in Leinster House for a long time. Believe it or not, I was actually having this conversation with a political advisor for another government party and other journalists. We were just shooting the breeze in Leinster House during the week and we were talking about the prospect of would Micheál Martin run for the Oras. We were talking about how popular he was, and according to John Lee today, that is it's a possibility. And you know, I think this has been rumoured for a long time, and we've seen in recent weeks this very quick and some would say dramatic succession of Jack Chambers. Others would say it's been a long time coming, but he was first appointed deputy leader of Fianna Fáil 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago actually, and then 2 weeks ago he became finance minister. So it's a lot of people are saying, is this Micheál Martin's great plan? John Lee suggesting that yes,
so he's
it is.
Anointing the leader of his choice if he feels it's in his gift to do that.
But I mean, the Fianna Fáil parliamentary party might have other things to say, but we'll see how that one plays out down the line. So what John Lee is suggesting is that Micheál Martin could be running for the Oras, and there's kind of a different set of, you know, options for him. He could step down if there was an autumn election. He could step down there after that election. He could start his campaign when he's Taoiseach. If there's a summer, or well, I guess a spring election we'll have to have next year, does he step down in the summertime, and does he kind of have a blitz of a campaign before the election in October? I think it'd be interesting to see what the Taoiseach has to say about this. I'm sure no doubt he'll be asked during the week, and I'm sure no doubt this will become a story as the summer goes on, because the Leinster House is rising for the summer.
So if you were a betting woman,
I think he'd do very well. And I think there's been this suggestion for a long time that Bertie Ahern might be Fianna Fáil's candidate for the presidency. I've always kind of had my doubts about that one. I know he's playing his cards close to his chest, but you know, when you're having conversations with people in Fianna Fáil, in some camps he's seen as kind of a messiah, he can do no wrong. But in other people go, well, he's a lot of skeletons in the closet that have been aired, and they will come back up to haunt him.
Presidential election campaigns, considering the political stakes are quite low in a way, are very bloody affairs in this country. Gerard Howland, as a former Fianna Fáil strategist.
Well, the line that fascinates me most in this story is the first, and particularly the use of two words. It's based on a number of, quote, senior colleagues, unquote. Micheál Martin doesn't have senior colleagues. Just to be clarified.
Explain.
Meaning that, of course, there are Fianna Fáil ministers and senior cabinet positions, but in terms of his leadership of the party, his decision-making process, he is, I think, you know, fairly peerless in terms of his decision-making processes. He's not particularly inclusive, and whatever he wants to do, I very much doubt that there are any colleagues, let alone senior ones, in the room, in the frame.
So nobody can look into their hearts and see what's in Micheál Martin's
mind. Now,
this
chat is perennial, and it's not the first bout of it. And of course, it is certainly realistic. It's possible, all of those good things, and he may well do exactly what is said, and it's a realistic option. But let's see, many a slip between cup and lip, and many a fence to be jumped and crossed between now and then.
And could it be too early? Could we potentially be looking at the election 7 years after 2025, if anyone is better at maths than me? Like, could he be looking that far ahead rather than this election? You know, he's still, there's a quote in the article, you know, he's 63, but he's quite a fish man, he's quite a healthy man, and he's well able for it. So perhaps it could be another 7 years.
So he's only a boy by the standards of some of the people around these days. So hang on, Gerard Howland, I'm not letting you off the hook that easily now. The other person mentioned there for Fianna Fáil is Bertie Ahern. What do you suspect is on his mind about a presidential election?
I'm not aware that he has any plans. I'm aware of the speculation, and I'm unaware of any plans.
Would you be surprised if he went for president?
Well, because I've no sense that he is, I would, for that reason.
Okay, we'll see what we can, I mean, we'll see
great,
what we can take out of
be
that.
It'd a great contest for Fianna Fáil's candidacy if it was Micheál versus Bertie. I think that'd be hilarious.
Oh, you'd hate yeah.
So they'd have their own bloodbath before the bloodbath of the campaign. Okay, so then into proper politics then, but it probably feeds into some of the stuff we've been saying about elections and Jack Chamber and everything. $5 billion budget boost on cards as coalition to defy central bank is the front of the Business Post. So Louise, the Minister for Finance, kind of seems to have surprised everybody, even his own some of his own colleagues when he announced that the budget's going a week early, and obviously a frenzy started then.
Yeah, this was the talk of Leinster House on Thursday, and I was getting ready to go into the office when Jack Chambers was on Morning Ireland, and the minute the words October 1st budget came out of his mouth, I was like, he's created so much work for me today. And he did. It just, everything in Leinster House went into overdrive. Everyone was asking each other when they thought the next election would be. I think someone, Fianna Gael, actually believed that it's going to be March 2025 and that Simon Harris is going to keep true to his word. A lot of Fianna Fáilers joking with me that they were going home to dust out the posters. So I think we don't really know when the election's going to be. In some ways, I believe Simon Harris when he says it's going to be March. I think it'd be a foolish thing to do. I think they should go in October, November. But it does certainly seem like they're getting ready. The Business Post, Conal Thomas speaking today about, we have the summary economic statement on Tuesday being released by Minister Chambers and Pascal Donoghue, the Public Expenditure Minister. And what that does is basically set out the context for the budget. Now it's worth saying, in the last couple of years that we've had the summary economic statement, and the government have actually ended up spending more in the budget than what they said. But the Business Post is reporting it's €5 billion.
Yeah, I think it gives them options by moving the budget earlier in the cycle, particularly when they've got a lot of good news around them at this point in time. I mean, I kind of hope they do run the election, really, because I think, you know,
in
October. Yeah, yeah, because February, March, I mean, it's a miserable time to have a general election. And one of the things I think about the local and European elections I really noticed was the amount of canvassers on doors and the amount of people actually talking to canvassers on doors and sometimes giving them hell. I mean, it was great to hear, you know, seeing that kind of interaction. But that bit is really important, I think, for the political system, because they really do take it seriously what people have to say on the doors. They document it, they analyse it, it has an effect on the decisions that they make. But people don't open the doors in February, and they're usually miserable as well, and it does influence how they vote. So I think changing the electoral cycle would actually be good for the country, to be honest.
Okay, you think it's time, basically, is it?
I mean, I know they probably want to hang on. They've got stuff they want to do. Even if they indicate a general election is coming, it has a big effect on the political system as well. Everything slows down. Even the civil servants slow down. And they do it sometimes with purpose, because they know a new minister is going to come in. Don't make any big decisions right now. It's not appropriate. We need the election. We need the new minister in to make that decision. So it does have an effect on the political system as a whole. It affects decision making. So I'd say they have a couple of things they want to get over the line before they call a general election.
Gerard, slightly relevant to this maybe, the Greens are going to be picking a leader by tomorrow. You've picked a piece in the Mail on Sunday that they're in a panic because Pippa Hackett might win, according to John Drennan.
Well, I'm not sure who is in a panic. The Greens have two issues. One is, I think, success in government in terms of substantial implementation of what they set out to do. And the other is a lot of resistance to the net effect of that. And, you know, their popularity has dwindled. They have two choices to proceed. One is effectively, I think, a continuity of Eamon Ryan, which is Roderick O'Gorman, and the other is more of a change and a riskier, which is Pippa Hackett, the senator from Offaly. And the way it was explained to me is, of about 3,500 members, the key is turnout, and a higher turnout may well favour Pippa Hackett. A lower turnout may favour Roderick O'Gorman. Let's wait and see. Apparently, the announcement will be in Bewley's Cafe at some stage tomorrow afternoon. But it is the three-party leaders. This is a tripartite government, and the personality and political view of that leader in that room from Monday evening will make a difference, I think, to the texture and political decision making of the government in its final months, which are arguably its most critical decisions.
Yeah. Okay, so Pippa Hackett could be a cat among the pigeons there. She would represent more of a change.
She I think, would be more combative.
Okay.
She represents the sort of climate wing, I think, of the party more so, right?
Yeah, I mean, to talk about wing
the climate.
Well, I just say that, I mean, the realos versus the, you know, there's a whole dynamic within the Green Party, whereas kind of some people would focus on the Green Party being more than just the climate issue, and some people would focus on the Green Party focusing uniformly on the climate issue. I think strategically for the Green Party, you know, they've had a lot of success on climate, and there probably would be a better strategy to focus on the climate issue because.
You think Roderick O'Gorman could seem more like a kind of a social justice warrior
person? I think in that area, those issues are obviously very complex, but I don't think they're going to win votes on those sorts of issues at the moment, whereas I think they have enough to stand on in relation to the climate issues. The other dynamic is people talking about rural versus urban. I think the Green Party is probably only going to survive from the next election if it builds up enough seats in it builds up enough of a vote in the urban areas. It's not going to win many seats, I think, in the rural areas. And I think that's kind of quite important for it to be able to survive, to get across the line, because in our electoral system, you do need sort of 8-10% of the vote in a given constituency to get across the line. So they need to think, where will they have enough votes to stack up enough to actually get people across the line? And it is probably these urban areas, but, you know, that kind of...
Okay.
The two kind of...
Now, speaking of votes, there's an Ireland Things poll, and obviously I'll ask you about this, Kevin, in a minute, but Louise, will you lay it out for us first? It's in the Sunday Independent today.
It's in the Sunday Independent today. Very interesting poll that was taken between July 4th and 5th. Margin of error is 2.7% with a sample size of 1,394 people, and interesting in some ways but continuing a trend we've seen in others. So Fine Gael are now the most popular party in the country. They're on 24%, up 2 points. Fianna Fáil, another boost for them, they're on 20%, up 3 points. Another quite damaging poll for Sinn Féin, I think it's fair to say. They're down 4 points to 18%. The Sock Dems down 1 on 4%. Green Party unchanged on 4. Aintu up 1 also on 4. Labour is unchanged on 3 points. Solidarity, People Before Profit, is up 1 point to 3%. And interestingly enough as well, especially I think in the wake of the local European elections, support for the independents is down by 3 points to 20%. So it's interesting because I think what the main focus of it is this is the least amount of popularity that Sinn Féin has had since before the 2020 general election.
This suggests they're half as popular as they were in opinion polls, like, what, a year ago?
Well, even 3 months ago. Well, sorry, a year ago, yes. But they kind of peaked around the cost of living crisis. Would it be around July, August sort of area, 2022?
Could they really be half as popular? Does it kind of make a... Doesn't make you wonder about opinion polls. What, their popularity is actually slashed in half within the space of like less than a year.
Yeah, I know. There's a couple of things, I guess. So on the one hand, you have the local election results. I mean, they only got 12% in those local election results. I think what's happened here is
which is very driven though by candidates, incumbency,
absolutely,
all kinds of issues.
Yeah. But I think what happens, I think there's a volatility in the electorate, and you can see that in lots of countries, in Britain, and you know, how reform surge, and it's just happening in every election everywhere you go, where people are changing their mind in the run-up to the elections, and political party support is going in all different directions. So I think what happens in the local elections here, my theory at least, is that the way in which Sinn Féin declined very rapidly coming into those local elections is, for a lot of people, they're only really deciding and looking at and crystallising what party they actually like around the time of an election campaign. So they might have a strong view on immigration or whatever, but they're only realising or connecting that with the political party that they like or dislike during a campaign, because that association thinks becomes a little bit stronger.
So ironically, you're saying we take all these polls with a pinch of salt, really, and that you're saying what many politicians say, the real poll is on election day.
I'm not actually that opposed to that idea, all right? You know, yeah. I think there is this fundamental volatility in the electorate right now, for which opinion polls, obviously, it becomes much more difficult because party support is a little bit more volatile, I guess. But
okay.
But coming back to the point about, I guess, more generally about opinion polls, I think, I think that is pretty accurate in this case. I mean, this particular poll, for example, we would have had, you know, the same ratios of people who would have. So in this poll, we asked people who they support in the local elections, and it would be weighted on the basis not just of demographics, but also how people voted. So it is 12% of people here, so they voted Sinn Féin in the local elections, and 18% or so. So you can very much see that gap for Sinn Féin, and obviously for Fianna Fáil going in the other direction, where 23% are voting for Fianna Fáil in the locals, and then 20% in the
I thought
the
what
general.
Was interesting in your article, Kevin, for the Sunday Independent, was you felt that, and this came through in the results, that Sinn Féin's lack of clarity on its immigration policy actually hurt it. And I think we could all see that on the outside, because I think it's the same for any of the political parties. I think one of the problems is they had a tendency to jump on what their policy wasn't and what it was, or just be very reactive.
Instead, they've all had a lack of clarity, haven't they?
Yeah.
They've all
and
been
actually,
shifting.
What the polling at the same time was showing was like 70% plus people were actually positively disposed to migration. They understood the importance importance of migration and refugees and how they contribute to the economy. But they said what they haven't seen is what is the government's policy for managing migration?
I think there were high numbers who were not positively disposed and thought we had too much migration. It was a majority at one point.
But generally, that's what the polls were saying. And they're concerned about different things. Like they see there's people in tents on the Grand Canal. What's happening? Will we have enough public services? Will you have accommodation? Are you going to use migrants to plug all the gaps in our health system, in our social care system? That's what they want to hear from the political party. So what they need to do is they need to set out a very clear stall for how they're going to support migration into the country and not just jump up whatever headline is coming at them.
I need to take a break. Louise Byrne, Gerard Howland, Tanya Ward and Dr. Kevin Cunningham staying with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Discover a healthcare team that's always here for you at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Louise Byrne, Gerard Howland, Tanya Ward and Dr. Kevin Cunningham still with us. So obviously, look, the important thing about the UK elections is what does it mean for us? Because everything's about us. In the Sunday Times, Hugh O'Connell is right. Come to dinner, Harris has high hopes for new beginnings. Gerard Howland, do you buy into the Great Reset? Our hopes seem to be very high that everything will change utterly now between us and the UK.
Well, provided we do not overestimate our own importance, which we tend to do vis-a-vis Brussels and London, there is a reset. It's very positive.
Do we not matter much to the UK, do you think?
Much less than we imagine and think. But I think we're going to matter more now over the next 5 years than we have over the last 10 years. It is 10 years since Mr. Cameron, then Prime Minister, expecting to lose the next election, promised a referendum on Brexit. It's 10 years later, we're now out of that vortex, but Britain is out of the EU. It's been a horrible
decade. Was this election
decade.
The reckoning in the UK, the kind of a delayed reckoning on Brexit and everything that came out of it?
No, I don't think so. I'm not sure about that at all. And I do know that Keir Starmer is saying very clearly he will not be back in the EU in his lifetime. And unfortunately, he's probably right. I don't think that's going
too late.
To be
that too
late.
Sailed,
the ship has sailed
it?
A long time ago. But in relation to ourselves, I mean, apart from the fact that he has been in Ireland a lot, he served in Northern Ireland. His key advisors are either Irish or have a lot of Irish experience or extraction.
He has a favourite sandwich shop in Belfast.
I see. Well, that is. I must go check it out. But there's very specific steps that are really mean a lot to us, including the fact that they're going to stay committed to staying in the Human Rights Convention, which upholds the Good Friday Agreement, which upholds the Brexit Agreement, and all of that structural stuff which the Tories were throwing overboard, including, by the way, Rwanda, which is then backwashing into migration flows onto this island. I think all of that will settle down. I think it's a government...
So we'll be dealing with reasonable people.
Yes, reasonable people who actually want to make the common travel area work well for both countries and want to have a decent relationship with Brussels and a decent relationship with us. And as well as that, I think we'll benefit from some affinity, which if we work it well, I think can heighten our access over the next 5 years.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, go on.
I was
going
to say, I don't think the Brexit-y thing is going to... I think you're absolutely right, George, just in relation to Brexit itself. I mean, if you look at the vote share, the places in... like Labour's vote share didn't increase very much in England at all, 1 or 2% here and there. From the last election. The last election was a disaster for the UK. So a lot of the gains are predicated on A, Scotland, the Labour Party very well in Scotland, and B, the Reform Party, particularly in those red wall constituencies, who basically took the Leave vote from the Tories. So that kind of Leave vote is now consolidated within the Reform Party and just hangs over not just the Conservative Party, but also the Labour Party as a sort of Damocles of some sort in relation to holding the line and holding Labour's position on issues like Brexit and that sort of stuff. Because Labour needs those particular constituencies to have any chance. And I can't see, and this is why he comes up with this line sort of saying, I'm not going to move at all, even though obviously like greater integration with the European Union probably resolves the biggest problem for the British government right now, which is an economic one, right?
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you have this issue for him politically and electorally speaking, whereas his majority, which is, you know, enormous in terms of the seat numbers, but very minimal in terms of vote
He's
share.
He's only 10% ahead of the Tories in vote share. They got 24, he got 34.
34 is extremely... Like 34 in a normal UK election, you probably wouldn't necessarily expect to be in government. If anything, you probably expect, at best case scenario, you're in a minority government of some sort, 34 and having. So it's kind of not really there.
You worked for them, for Labour, didn't you, for a time?
Yeah,
a different
like
Labour party.
Are they
genius at vote managing, or did they just get lucky with Reform kind of queering the pitch there?
They got lucky. I mean, the Labour Party, the way the UK... British system, certainly there's a big difference between British politics and Irish politics and the way in which it works. UK parties, particularly the Labour Party, is very, very centralised control. It probably, when people talk about Sinn Féin here, it kind of reminds me a little bit of Sinn Féin, but even more so, that kind of level of central control in relation to like where you put your leaflets out, what key seats are, what candidates go into what constituencies. Like a big difference between Irish and British politicians are, you know, if you compare, say, Simon Harris, you know, with Keir Starmer, Simon Harris became a politician by working very hard, becoming a councillor. You know, most Irish politicians go through the process of becoming a councillor and so on. Most of the senior politicians in the Labour Party, at least, tend to be ones who are kind of parachuted into safe seats, basically. And that's, it creates a very different type of politician as well, and a very different type of organisation as well that sits behind it. So when you're identifying the key seats, it's like the swing states in the United States. That's the sort of stuff I would have been doing. So there's, would have been about 100 constituencies that you really focus on, and that's where, you know, people start to worry, people start to be very concerned about the red wall, even though, as you say, Brendan, in the UK most people are actually like against most people are disappointed with the fact that Britain have left the European Union. But the problem for the Labour Party in terms of those voters is they're stacked up in urban areas. They're not necessarily distributed in the
constituencies. I think the Labour Party played it too careful, really, in the election, and probably needs to do more to inspire people, even though their messaging was very disciplined, to be honest. And I suppose if you read what was that?
Change.
Yeah, change. Yeah, I mean, like some of the stuff that jumped out to me, you know, public service is a privilege, a return to politics of service. Service is a precondition for hope. I mean, there's some very good messaging in what they had to say, but they failed to electrify people. And I mean, they know well they have an issue, but it's coming through in the coverage.
They don't have any money to do any
of this stuff.
Britain's broke.
Yeah.
Growth, but, apparently. Like, it's like, you remember that film Being There, Chauncey Gardner, like this gardener who accidentally ended up advising the President of America, he would say things like, growth will come in the spring. Yeah. And they were all like,
it's even worse than that. They're broke, and the 20% of their people are in poverty. So that's nearly three times the population of Ireland are living in poverty. Working people who can't put food on the table. That's what they are living. And this is why people have voted for Reform. They're looking for some sort of change. They've lost faith in politics. Certainly what's coming through in the coverage is they need to be in permanent campaign mode to beat Reform now, because that's all they do. Nigel Farage will be in campaign mode. He'll land loads of content. He'll say lots of controversial things. And at the same time, they will have to change life for people on the ground. They'll have to give them hope. There's some of the threads of that in their manifesto. But what Keir Starmer has to do is he has to do some radical thinking and introduce some radical measures if he's going to win that next election.
Okay. Before we move on from that, Louise, can I go back to you? Are they very excited in Leinster House about all this? Are they thinking it's a Christmas?
Yeah, they are. And I mean, I think, like, we've heard this new phrase over the last couple of days, the Great Reset, and it's an opportunity for Great Reset and all the rest of it. But I mean, I think if you look back at even the last 6 months to a year of the relationship with the British government, and everyone talks about how poor it was during Brexit, but it's been very, very weak over the last year. You've had the Legacy Act, you've had that controversy, you have the fact that the Irish government is taking an interstate case against the Legacy Act. And I was listening to Simon Harris on Sky News earlier, and he did an interview with Stephen Murphy, and he was asked, you know, are you going to drop this case now? And he was like, well, we'll take it step by step. So that is obviously a big sticking point. And you've also had the whole immigration thing. It's only a couple of months ago since Rishi Sunak, when he was Prime Minister, went on, I think it was ITV, and he said, no, we're not interested in a deal with Ireland on immigration. We're not taking those immigrants back. And that led to quite a bit of friction between the Irish and the British governments. And I think what's interesting is the things that were the sticking points between the Irish government and the Tories are the things that Labour have said they're going to row back on, like the Rwanda Act, Rwanda Act, like the Legacy Act.
And symbols and stuff are important here. Is it Hugh O'Connell that piece come for dinner? Mm. So Simon Harris has been invited for dinner before. There's a meeting of world leaders in London, but Simon Harris is the one having dinner with Keir Starmer the night before.
Yeah, so this is a meeting of the European political community, and that was to take place in Oxfordshire on, I think it's July 18th. And when the Taoiseach and the PM had their phone conversation on Friday evening, Mr. Starmer invited Mr. Harris over for dinner the evening beforehand. And one of the quotes that Hugh has in the Sunday Times is he could have invited Macron. So, I mean, that's a good point. He could have invited Macron.
I don't think anyone's inviting Macron anywhere. So it's all for that. It's like we had the neighbours from hell and now suddenly.
Yeah.
So on Macron, you're seamlessly moving into to France. And you picked a piece in the Sunday Independent by Julia Maloney, who lives in, do they call it La France Profonde, out in the countryside. And she's explaining to what Tanya was saying there earlier about why the right might be popular with these forgotten people.
Yes, it's a place called, and I hope my French is nil, so I'll try and pronounce it, Tarn, T-A-R-N. It's an industrial area. It's really down at heel. It's banjaxed. It's where François Mitterrand resurrected his political career, won the presidency in 1980, promising rejuvenation, a reconnection with these lost people and these lost places. And Macron has completely lost them. And France has left them behind. And they are the yellow vests that protested over the past few years. They are people swinging from left and sometimes very left to very right, and sometimes because we think left and right is different, we ignore the similarities. And what both the far left and the far right are for is massive state intervention in various ways. And so those people in those situations, and Tanya was talking about people who cannot put a meal on the table perhaps, or pay the rent or whatever, the story
is... So they're
is,
not all racists, they're just...
No.
And
somebody's
and,
listening to
and
us.
And research, I mean, the organisations they're tagging on have very significant, if not outwardly vile, racist histories or even presence. But these people are voting and affiliating with these brands of change in spite of rather than because of. So it goes back to Hillary Clinton in 2016 calling all these people deplorables. That's a profound mistake. There's a lot to deplore around the ether of these organisations. But the people who are massing behind them do so from a place of weakness, of vulnerability, and
yeah.
fear for
I saw,
themselves.
I saw Channel 4, the Irish guy on Channel 4, Pádraig, out anyway in a village with the local RN candidate, yeah. Right? There was no talk about immigration, really. Like it was kind of good local politics is what they were at, like, and it looked good. Kevin, very briefly, you picked a piece by Owen O'Malley, Swing to the Far Right, not about racism, but lost communities, and it's into this.
That's exactly it, yeah. And he mentions the idea of the populist nationalist parties with roots in fascism, racism, and achieve power by suppressing their more extreme views rather than actually leveraging them. And this idea also that the liberal centre, as it used to be back in the sort of third way of Blair and that sort of stuff, has gone, and now the kind of centre is predicated on this idea of the community and this kind of moving back towards the community. I think that's essentially what a lot of it is. And I think years ago,
so what does that mean for the centre grown throughout Europe then?
In terms of like reintegrating itself into the community, because I think a lot of this is a function of the individualization of society, the kind of atomization stuff, and people looking for kind of more connections with other people. I think it's kind of connected to all this sort of stuff.
So the centre are looking a bit like an out-of-touch elite at the moment to a lot of communities, yeah?
But I think it's also, I don't know if you've ever read the Robert Putnam book, Bowling Alone, and obviously written many, many years ago, but I think it's a reflection of the same sort of dynamic of how this is where there are clearly votes because the political system is focused on very different angles, and now it's kind of going into a slightly different.
Do you know what's really disturbing about it, if they come to power, because this is the hard right. This is not just the right. Some of the things they're proposing, like to give police officers the presumption if they use force that they were entitled to defend themselves. They're talking about people who have dual nationality not being allowed to perform certain functions in government. So even Irish people that might have French citizenship won't be able to perform certain functions in government. They're talking about changing the very basis of what the French identity is, which is equality, fraternity and liberty. They're actually talking about changing the constitution to get rid of that very basic concept. So this that's why people are really worried about what's happening. The political system has lost control. The political parties, the mainstream, have failed the French for them to vote for this political party.
OK, we take a break. Louise Byrne, Gerard Howland, Tanya Ward and Dr Kevin Cunningham staying with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel still with us, Louise Byrne, Gerard Howland, Tanya Ward and Dr Kevin Cunningham. Bit of sad news just reaching us. Former Mayo, Leitrim and Galway manager John O'Mahony has died at the age of 71. He was a native of Kilmovie in County Mayo. He had two stints as manager of his home county where he famously led Neighbours Galway, while he famously led Neighbours Galway to their most recent All-Ireland senior football titles around the turn of the century in 1998 and 2001. He was elected as a Fine Gael TD in Mayo at the 2007 general election, and he served in that position until 2016, and in May of 2016, then Taoiseach Enda Kenny nominated him to the 25th Shannon. So we send our condolences to the family and friends of John O'Mahony, who has died at the age of 71. Back to our agenda today. Gerard Howland, is Joe Biden going to be the candidate?
If he is, he won't be the president, and he has to make up his mind, or his wife has to make up her mind. Something has to happen, and if not, somebody at the top of the Democratic Party has to take their courage into their hand. This is the most significant election since 1860, when Abraham Lincoln was elected. There won't be a civil war this time, but the cultural and legal consequences are the most serious.
But have they an option?
They have an option, yeah. Which is somebody who is competent. And anyone who's competent is better than the president.
OK, Tanya?
Yeah, I mean, I just think the Biden strategy of, look, yes, I'm a changed man, but I've achieved all these different things. It just isn't enough. It's not cutting through. And one of the things you can see in the US media is they are fixated now on Biden's capacity and missing the focus on Trump, to be honest. I mean, this week, there's some really scary dystopian stuff that came out around the Trump campaign. I mean, the Supreme Court have taken the straitjacket off the president. He's going to be able to kill you, basically, and that he won't be held accountable. But what also came out this week was about the Heritage Foundation, which effectively has a manifesto. Some very disturbing stuff in that.
OK, right. I take all that.
And the media has missed that because they've just been focused on Biden.
Yeah, because Kevin Cunningham, as I saw one person describe me, everyone's now holding their breath every time he talks or every time he appears anywhere.
Yeah, I think it's incredible. It's a terrible strategy, obviously, of the Democratic Party. And I think one of the things that's quite regrettable in some respects is that I think politicians can get away with perhaps mistruths about their public policies or even about Donald Trump's behaviour, but trying to pretend that what people saw very clearly wasn't happening, it's just kind of ridiculous. So I think it's going to be very difficult for the Democrats to come back unless Biden actually does loads of debates with Donald Trump and proves something that's probably not going to happen, that he's going to be much better. I was talking to through the polling network, you might say, some people who work in the Biden and Democratic campaigns before, and they said in the run-up to the particular debate that they did all the debate prep. They did enormous amounts of it. Trump didn't get much debate prep, but they did it all in the week up, and they practiced during the day, and obviously allowed Joe to have regular naps and all that sort of stuff. And the idea was by practicing just during the day, it wasn't giving them sort of like game conditions that, you know, yeah, the debate was actually at night.
Somebody apparently according to the New York Times, somebody who's had really accurate stories from inside the Biden camp was reporting yesterday that he's okay between 10 and 4 generally, that's all you can rely on him for.
And then having this debate very late at night was obviously going to be very problematic. I think one of the things, just from a polling perspective, very finally, is that they're sometimes trying to pretend that Biden is actually the strongest candidate, but that's just an artifact of the fact that there's a large number of don't knows on all the other alternatives, purely because people don't know who those alternatives actually are. So there's been some
Put someone else in there, they will gain momentum.
So there's been some research to show that if Pete Buttigieg was actually the candidate, he would be well ahead of Trump if he actually was. And you can see how Michelle Obama is already ahead because she has that recognition and she's got like 10 points on Trump. So anyone actually would beat him other than
Joe. So look, if the Biden people are listening, the pressure is still on from Ireland anyway. Us in the New York Times now, and the Skibbereen Eagle maybe as well. All right, thanks very much to my panel today, Louise Byrne, Gerard Howland, Tanya Ward and Dr Kevin Cunningham. And it's just 12 noon now, and we'll go to the newsroom and Susan Jackson.